Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Grueling Truths Tuesday Night Boxing Show. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster, and joining me as always is my co-host, Joe Rodriguez.
Hey, Mike, excited to be on as usual.
Well, we got another great show. Last week we had former welterweight champion Carlos Palomino. Our guest tonight had a career record of 44 wins, 5 losses, 1 draw with 36 knockouts. It was a light heavyweight champion of the world. Help me welcome to the Grueling Truth, Donnie Lalonde.
Thank you. Really nice to be here, guys. I love Carlos Palomino.
He was a great guest, too. Very intelligent man.
Yeah, he always came across that way. I'm happy to hear he's still happy. I mean, healthy and well.
Yep, he sounded good. Let's start off. You grew up, I believe you were born in Kitchener, Canada. Tell us what it was a little like, your early childhood growing up in Canada.
Well, I was born in Kitchener, that's correct, which is right near Toronto. And at 3, we moved to British Columbia, which near in Vancouver. That's where, my father's family, they worked in, lumber mills and stuff like that. They were lumbermen, lumberjacks, I guess you'd say. And so we moved at a very young age to Vancouver, and then, you know, my parents split up, and my mom stayed there, met another guy, and he became a very abusive, sick, demented person, and you know, just kind of like right after they got married. And so I really kind of grew up in Vancouver. And then at 14, we moved to Winnipeg, which is where my stepfather's from, and then at 15 I left home. So, we moved around a lot. I didn't really go to the same school for a whole year. I don't know if I ever went to the same school throughout a whole year, maybe once or something. And so we moved around. I always had to take on the neighborhood bully, the school tough guy, to kind of show where I stood within the school hierarchy. And so that's kind of what got me into boxing, is I had to kind of protect myself. And my mom just said, if you have to fight every school we move to, you're going to have to, you know, get some lessons. So she took me to a boxing gym, and that's where it all began.
Well, you talked a little bit about your mother got remarried. I think you were around 12 years old. He was abusive. What kind of effect did that have on you at such an early age, and what kind of effect has it had on you throughout your life?
Well, I think actually, there's pros and cons to everything, and life happens to everybody. It's what I've learned, and it's what we do with what happens to us. So, my dad, my biological father, taught me by being who he was everything I didn't want to be, which, kind of sounds odd in a sense, maybe you could say, but really it was very empowering because it made me very clear what paths in life I didn't want to take, which is very helpful. You know, a lot of people don't get that opportunity to see in such a clear light where you don't want to go. And then my stepfather, the physical abuse to myself and the other siblings and my mother especially was horrific. It was very scarring. It was very traumatic. And what I learned from that at a very young age, I was 12 years old when I started working. I was just like, I got to get out of this house. He might kill my mom and my brother, but he's not going to kill me. I'm getting out of here, because I kept begging my mother to leave and she wouldn't. So I just decided I was going to leave. So at 12 years old, I started working instead of going to school, and kind of realized at a very young age that I got to take care of myself. Because nobody in the house was kind of like capable of it. Not that my mother didn't want to. She got into alcohol and became very beaten woman and lost all of herself kind of esteem or capacity to take care of herself. So, I mean, obviously it was very scarring, but, you know, I try to take the lessons from it, and I just got on with my life.
When and what made you want to try boxing? Was it your partly your experience with the abusive relationship you had with your stepfather?
No, actually, well, let me say, let me think about that question. It's interesting. I think it had as much to do with my father leaving when I was so young and me taking it very personally that I, you know, wasn't, I felt unloved or unworthy of his love, I guess you could say. And so in feeling that, you have a low self-esteem. People pick on you. I wasn't an aggressive person at all, but I was just blessed with the ability to know how to defend myself and take care of myself. It just literally came naturally. And so people would try and pick on me, and they couldn't because I would defend myself. And then I realized, like I said, like I used to literally, I went to Catholic school in grade 1 and 2. And the Protestant school was on the other side of the housing project we lived in East Vancouver. And I had to fight through the Protestants to get to Catholic school. So literally, at times my mother would say, well, if you have to fight your way to school, you still have to get there on time. So I'm going to come downstairs and I'm going to referee. And as soon as one kid gets the better of the other, that's when it ends and you move on to the next kid because you've got to get to school on time. And so she would come down, literally referee, and when one was getting the better of the other, she would say, okay, that's it. You, this guy won. Now it's the next guy. You've got to get to school. And so then that's when she said, you got to, you know, go to a boxing gym because, you know, you got to fight your way to school. You need to have this education. So that's really what brought me was more just self-defense. And then I think, though, I mean, I could say to your question, when you've been, you know, like when you say 11 or 12 years old, and I'm what, like 90 pounds, and a 220-year-old man is beating on you, it kind of puts in perspective when you're in a boxing ring with a guy your size, and all of a sudden the punches don't hurt so much, and, you know, your punches do because you have a lot of, let's say, maybe anger or pain inside of you that you're expressing through boxing. So I don't know. I was a natural athlete, and boxing came pretty comfortably to me. But I think it was probably a combination of both, or what I made of both.
All right. We had a couple guests. Like I said, we had Carlos Palomino, who I think only had like 34 or 35 amateur fights. We had Tim Witherspoon a week or two before that, who I think he only had like 12 or 13 amateur fights. Tell us a little bit about your amateur career and... And what made you turn pro after a short amateur career?
As I mentioned, I started boxing to defend myself, and I left home at a very young age. I actually left home for good at 15 because I knew I had to make a living. So, you know, I mean, I didn't know really what I wanted at first. I mean, at first I was working construction, smoking pot, smoking cigarettes, drinking beer. I mean, it was this. mid-70s, I was trying everything that would show me some kind of direction in life, and nothing was working, and I was watching amateur boxing on TV one day, and I said to my brother, we were both sitting there, and I said, I mean, look at that guy in the corner. Doesn't he look like he has so much self-confidence, self-esteem, feels so good about himself? And he goes, yeah, well, what does that mean to you or me? I said, well, wouldn't you like to feel that way about yourself one day? I said, I would like to feel one day, just even one day in my life, as good as he looks, like he feels about himself today. And he goes, what do you want to do? I said, I want to try boxing. So we literally put out our cigarettes, went for a five-mile run in the snowstorm in Kitchener, Ontario. I was back there at that time because I left home and went there, hitchhiked there to start working construction. And my older brother had a opening there for me. And so I started boxing basically just to kind of find some direction in life. And it gave me, I mean, after the first day of being there, I told my brother, I said, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life. I love this. And so I just started boxing mainly from there. But I was boxing, you know, for out of survival and livelihood. So amateur really had no, I had no interest in it. And I tried to turn pro actually once before even having an amateur fight. But Scott Ledoux, you could find the date, because Scott Ledoux fought a guy named Sylvester Wilder. And Wilder was a dive artist, so he didn't even last a minute of the first round, maybe, or two. And the whole crowd went crazy. I was going to be the walk-up belt, and the promoter comes in the dressing room after, and he goes, "Donnie, I'm sorry, but you're not going to turn pro tonight. You need some amateur fights anyway." And I said, "Why is that?" And he goes, "These guys, these fans are going to kill me, you know, because they were booing, going crazy because it was such a bad main event." So I didn't get a chance to. So I had 15 amateur fights. Didn't really focus a lot on it. I was kind of like bored and frustrated that I even had to do it. So I had a mediocre amateur career, and until I turned pro, I really wasn't all that interested. And then eventually he gave me an opportunity to turn pro, and I think it was April 1980. And the next thing I did, I think it was like more like February or March, and then I had an opportunity to box Tommy Hearns. He was, I walked in the gym to train, and that same promoter, Tom Burns is his name, from Winnipeg, I heard him on the phone. He goes, "Manny," and I didn't know any other Manny, so here's Manuel Stewart. He goes, "Manny, I would love for somebody to box Tommy Hearns in Winnipeg, but nobody in this town is crazy enough to do that." Tommy was 26-0, 25 knockouts at the time. And so I went up to him. I said, "Tommy, I will. What are you talking about? I will." And he goes, "Donnie, shut up. I'm talking to Manuel Stewart." I'm like, I know. I'll box Tommy Hearns." He goes, hold on, Manny. I think I found somebody. So they brought him in to do an exhibition for Ralph Racine, who was put in a coma by Gaetan Hart.
Gaetan Hart, wasn't it? Yeah.
Correct, Gaetan Hart. And so they wanted to raise some money for Ralph, and so they brought Tommy in to do the exhibition. And so after I boxed Tommy, I had a full-time job at the time, and it was like kind of like a pretty good job for, you know, kid off the street with not much education. But all the guys at work the next day were like, "Donnie, what the hell are you doing here? You got to quit. You got to go do boxing full-time." And I had phone calls from guys saying, "Donnie, I mean, it's early because you're just starting, but I can get you rated and only a few more fights. You can box. I mean, if you can box Tommy Hearns like that, you got to be boxing full-time." So that's when I just said, "Okay, I guess I got to take this very seriously," and started full-time after the Hearns exhibition.
Well, you mentioned your first fight, your debut, and you're right. It was in April. We just passed the anniversary of it, April 1980. What do you remember about your first fight?
Well, I was petrified. And I remember that the guy I fought, Ken Boilermaker Nichols, he was a biker in our town, and there were bike gangs there, and it was like they were intimidating people our whole life. If you remember the late 70s, it was like, you know, like bikers was the big thing. I mean, nowadays, it's people with guns or, you know, police with these, what are they called? I can't remember anyway. They shoot people, they don't kill them, but then they almost kill them, and then they die. But anyway, like, it's a different world today. But back then, chains, knives, bike gangs, you know, those are the bad guys. And this guy drives a motorcycle, a Harley Davidson, up the escalators into the arena, right to the ring, and has the whole arena full of these bikers. And I'm like, "Oh, my God, what am I doing here?" You know. But I was scared to death. But about a minute and a half into the second round, I see the ref waving his hands, and I'm thinking, "Oh my God, I don't know who won, but I'm just glad this is over." And I get to the center of the ring, and the ref lifts my hand up, and I look over at the other guy. He's all bleeding and cut up and beat up, and he looks at me with a smile. He goes, "Boy, that must have been fun." And I said, "For who? I'm exhausted." He goes, "What? Breaking your hands on my face? You beat the shit out of me." Anyway. So what I remember about it is I was petrified going in, and I was exhausted by the end of it. It was only a round and a half.
All right. You won your first four fights, and then you lost your fifth fight. I believe it was a six-round decision to Wilbert Vampire Johnson. What kind of impact? You later avenged that loss, I think, like 6 or 7 months later. But what kind of impact did that loss have on you as a boxer, and did you make any changes from that loss?
It was a very impactful fight. It's a funny question you asked, because in the first round I broke the metacarpal on my index finger. And, of course, because it was the first round, it was a six-round fight, I had to keep punching. I really drove the knuckle down and disformed the first knuckle in my hand, the index finger. And so it was a very painful fight. I remember that. And then I remember going to the to his corner after the fight, following him back, just to say good fight. I knew the corner and Pete Susan's, and I just was saying good fight, you know. And as I was walking back towards that was before they announced it, right after the fight, Pete threw a big bucket of water, like a splash of water out of a sponge, to Wilbur's face and said, "You effing bum, you could have won that fight." They didn't even think they won. But in Winnipeg at the time, kind of some mafia-connected people controlled boxing, and they didn't want any other local heroes. They wanted the mafioso's son to be the local hero, so they wanted to get me knocked off because people were starting to follow me. And so it was very, very influential in my life because, number one, I realized, obviously I could fight because I thought he's a pretty good fighter vampire at the time, at the level I was at, and I did beat him. And when I fought him in a rematch, I knocked him out, I believe, in the first or second round, and kind of really showed myself. I took 6 months just to get my hand back together to be able to fight, and that was my next fight, and then I really showed myself I could fight. But then I also learned a lot about the business in that fight and realized I have to really protect myself. And, I couldn't count on the promoter to match me right. I couldn't count on the people behind the whole boxing world there. And I had to really start paying attention to what I was doing. And so it really gave me a wake-up call to reality and that I had to take control of my own life and my career. So I did. I also had to adjust my style because my right hand was so damaged. And, those are a couple things that really impacted. And if you notice, after that, I fought a few times, like kind of here and there. And then I fought, my next fight after him was in Montreal. And check this out. After the fight that I won, the rematch, the mafioso group came to me and said, "Donnie, as you know, we control boxing in Winnipeg. We control boxing in Toronto. We control boxing in Montreal. You either fight for us or you got to leave the country." And I said, to myself, I'm thinking like, I really don't have a choice. I didn't have a lot of money. And they did control boxing. What did I really care? I didn't want to be a mafia-owned fighter, but at the same time, if that's the game, I got to do what I got to do to get fights. I signed with them. So the first fight, they brought me to Montreal to fight a guy who had 43 fights at the time, I think, maybe 42, and I was 6-1 with very little amateur background, and the arena was sold out. Gaetan Hart actually was the main event on that one against a guy named Mario Cousin, and then I was the semi-main event against the guy I fought, Jean-Claude Leclerc. And the hockey arena was sold out, and they weren't there to watch me beat this guy because he was from Montreal. And I knocked him out in the second round, flat on his face, and then the mafia guy after the fight comes in the dressing room and is like, "Good kid, Johnny. Where are you going after the fight?" I said, "I'm going to see my mom in Kitchener." He goes, "Okay, I'll give you a ride." I said, "No, it's okay. I'll get a bus. I'll walk. I'll get there on my own. Don't worry." And he goes, No. He goes, "I'll give you a ride." I said, "Kenny, I don't want a ride. I'll get my own way there." And he goes, "I'm not asking you. I'm telling you I'm giving you a ride." So I said, "Okay, I'll take a ride." And so I go for a ride with him in his limousine, 600 miles from Kitchener. And on the way, he goes, "Okay, now listen. Obviously, you see what we tried to do. We tried to get you knocked off. But you earned our respect tonight. We've all talked about it, and we want to invite you in to become a home fighter." And I said, "Listen, I will never be your home fighter. I will never be one of you guys. I will leave the country, but I'm not going to do this anymore. What I want is to buy my contract back from you." They gave me no money for it. And so he said, "I'll get back to you on this." So after about a month, he got back to me, and he goes, "If you really want your freedom, you can have it. But two conditions. One is you give me $10,000, which at the time was a lot of money, and the other is you leave the country. You don't fight in Winnipeg anymore." And I said, "I agreed to both. I borrowed money, got him the $10,000, and then you'll see I fought fights in different places for a while after that." But anyway, I did go back and fight and face the wrath of those guys afterwards, but that's a different story. But anyway, I think I answered your question.
Yeah.
Well, one of the fascinating things I found about your career was very interesting. You injured your shoulder playing hockey. It had to change your boxing style. What adjustments did you have to make to compensate for that shoulder injury?
Well, you know, think about it now for a second, because that was my left shoulder. So I started my career with a limited left shoulder, but I had had one surgery before I turned pro that they put a staple in, and then in roofing a house and a number of other things, I damaged it more. I was falling off a roof, and I caught on with that arm, and I tore the staple out. And so then I had to use my other arm. Luckily, I caught it. It was a long ways down. So I damaged the shoulder quite a bit there. Then I would damage it sparring. And then just before the 1983 fight against Roddy McDonald for the Canadian Championship, I tore it out again really badly boxing in a fight in Minnesota. My left shoulder went out in the first round, and I destroyed my right hand in the second round. Luckily, the ref stopped the fight because of the cut right after I landed that right hand. Otherwise, I was thinking, what am I going to hit him with now, an elbow or a headbutt? I didn't know what I was going to hit with, because my left shoulder was hanging out, and my right arm hand was in so much pain, it was unbelievable. So anyway, after that, I got another shoulder surgery. So what it did, actually, again, if you look at, you know, the old theory, life happens, is what you make of it. I just realized, okay, this left shoulder's really messed up. I've got to do as much as I can with it. I had a very awkward kind of idea of what I was going to do with it, kind of use it as a distraction. And then I had to really refine my right hand. And I give a lot of credit to my trainer, Pete Piper at the time, who's since passed, and Al Sparks, who's also since passed. Those two guys really helped me refine my right hand. And I had to really refine my right hand because it was so damaged from the initial break and subsequent fighting with the break that I had to be very delicate where I hit a person on the head. Be very careful, because if I hit him anywhere solid, the middle knuckle at this point was starting to deteriorate quickly because it would take most of the impact. So what it did is it made me really refine my boxing and really made me think of what movement I would use and what when I would throw punches and how carefully and delicately I would have to do it. So it actually made me a better fighter, because it made me really have to hone in on the few little possibilities I had to land something after trying to make a miss.
All right, real quick, I want to remind listeners we're talking to former world light heavyweight champion Donnie Lalonde. Donnie, we go to 1985, a fight that I found really interesting was your fight with Willie Edwards. It was for the NABF Light Heavyweight Championship. Edwards stopped you in 9 rounds, but from everything I've read, there was apparently some funny business going on with his gloves. Can you tell us a little bit about that night?
Sure, yeah. From the time that I separated my shoulder, well, from the time of that fight in Montreal on, I had to basically promote my own fights or fight for other promoters that were not connected in Canada. The Winnipeg comeback was a very dangerous thing to do because of the threat I was receiving from the people I had agreed to not come back with. But I had to promote the shows myself. So I had got a friend of mine, Billy Boulanger, who ended up promoting a number of my fights, to be the promoter, because we couldn't do both, couldn't be the promoter and the fighter at the time. And so I got him to be the promoter of record. And I was number 10 in the world, and I contacted Michael Spinks's people to try and put a fight together with Spinks, Don Majewski, still in the game. And Don said, well, I mean, you know, if you guys can come up with $100,000, Michael will fight you. And so I was like, okay. He said, but you got to fight somebody credible, you know, enough to for the TV to buy it, you know. So he said, and so we went over the available contenders, and I said, this guy is a really dangerous guy to fight. Nobody wants to fight him, but he's the kind of guy, if you beat him, it'll earn you the shot. So I took the Edwards fight and promoted the fight. And this is a crazy story. I don't think I told anybody in public, but I was arrested in Indianapolis, well, in Hammond, Indiana, Anderson, Indiana, just before, like 10 days before the fight, maybe a week. I was in Indiana training. I used to go down there to train with Marvin Johnson and all the great fighters down in Indianapolis at the time. Ronnie Essett, Vampire Johnson. There was a bunch of guys at the time. And I was just with a friend who had an American Express traveler's check and Canadian funds. I was driving the car. He bought a hamburger, a shrimp burger, but his license had expired. So a few minutes later, police pull over. The guy at the till phoned the police and said he thought we had stolen the money because the guy had an expired driver's license as ID from Canada. He didn't realize that the American Express travel check was also Canadian, so we were obviously Canadian. But anyway, he didn't realize that. They phoned the police. The police arrested us and threw me in jail and said, there's no court date for you for 3 months. It was like a kangaroo court thing. And I said, I can't do that. I have a fight in 10 days. Well, that was like, let's say, on a Friday. I know I was in jail 3 or 4 days, couldn't train, couldn't eat because I wouldn't eat that kind of food. So I traded my food for juice, so I just went on a juice fast. Anyway, get through the whole jail thing, get out of jail in time to get to the fight Edwards, and, you know, I'm driving to the arena, counting cars in the parking lot, wondering if I'm going to make money or lose money on the fight, and I thought I fought a good fight up until, I think it was the 8th round, Edwards hit me with a left hook. Well, I know what happened. I think between the 7th and 8th round, there was a split in his gloves, and they changed gloves. And then the 8th round, I mean, we'd been boxing already for 8 rounds. He didn't hurt me. He hit me with a left hook that I went down and got up 4 times from. I never knew my name again that day until later in the day. I mean, I was hurt really badly from that punch. In the next round, the ref stopped the fight. Well, 20 years later, a friend of mine, remember I was the promoter, so I told my friend, I said, look, take care of this guy. They only had 2 guys in the corner, Billy Goots and, super middleweight champion, Lindell Holmes. So they were in Edwards' corner. And when they changed the gloves, they put brass knuckles on Billy Edwards' hands, left hand. And my friend, who I asked to take care of him in the corner, be his third man, and don't be biased, you know, be a fair guy, saw them do this. And when he saw them do that, they saw him see them do that and kind of like gave him a motion of you say something and you're dead by crossing their finger across his throat and putting their hand on his mouth first. And he never told me that for 20 years. Like 20 years later, I get a phone call from this guy and he goes, do you remember that fight? And he goes, I got to tell you something. We've got to go meet for lunch. And so we met for lunch, and he goes, I've been holding this for 20 years. I've been so afraid. I was afraid of these guys all this time, but I can't live with it anymore. I just have to tell you what happened in between rounds. And he told me that they put brass knuckles on him in between rounds. So anyway, I lost that fight, but I learned a lot from it. And then I fought, I fought anyway in Wheeling, West Virginia, Jamie the Featherman Howe. And Dave Wolf saw that fight on ESPN. And right after that, I decided I needed a true management and I couldn't be promoting my own fights. So I was talking to Top Rank about doing that. That's why I got the ESPN shot. But I wanted a manager. And I approached Dave Wolf and, well, at first Mike Trainer, but then I ended up with Dave Wolf because Mike and Ray had just signed Sean O'Sullivan and they wouldn't take on another fighter. So I went with Dave Wolf, who, you know, was a very close second anyway. And that's when my career really sort of became a sane career because I had a real manager. He got me with the trainer and Teddy Atlas, which, as you know, is another whole crazy story. But anyway, it was a more sane part of my life and career from 85 on after the Edwards.
All right, real quick. Real quick, I need to remind listeners, our first half hour is live. The last 15 minutes is archive time. So at the top of the hour, you can hear the last 15 minutes, which are coming up on the Grueling Truth radio network. So you talked about Teddy Atlas, Dave Wolf. I know you guys kind of clashed, but I don't think anybody ever worked with Teddy Atlas that didn't clash at some point. And then I know you went and hired Tommy Gallagher, who I think was with Evander Holyfield for a little while, and Bobby Cassidy, who was a solid, you know, contender, I think, in the 70s. Your first fight with those guys, you outpointed Mustafa Hamsho, which I actually watched that fight the other day. Great fight. I mean, Hamsho, I think, really took it to you the first four or five rounds, and then you just dominated the rest of the fight. Then you went on to fight Eddie Davis for the light heavyweight title, which you won in a second-round knockout, where I haven't seen too many people get beat as badly as Eddie Davis did that night. You want to talk a little bit about the Hamsho fight and about winning a title against Eddie Davis?
Sure. The Hamsho fight was awesome because about 5 months before it or 4 months before it, I was diagnosed by six different specialists and six different injuries with six career-ending injuries all at the same time. And a lot of it came from my time with Teddy. I was just, like, beaten down, and he would have me training no matter how hurt I was. I had all these injuries, and he never gave any, it's all in your head. I'm like, Teddy, you don't see the scar on my shoulder with the pin in my shoulder? I've got a pin in my shoulder. You don't see my hands deformed? You don't see how swollen it is? You know, like, are you literally insane? You can't see how injured I am? So he would keep me training through all that stuff, and it got to a point, literally, where I was, like, almost a cripple. I couldn't run, I couldn't box, I couldn't straighten my arms, I had tennis elbow and both arms. Anyway, so I was literally like being written off. Dave signed me to fight a guy named John Maria Mebe in the Ivory Coast for $150,000. He goes, Donnie, you just got to give this up. You're over. You're a wreck, you know. And I said, no, Dave, I'm going to find a natural way to cure all this stuff, and I'm going to keep going. So that happened. That's another whole story I won't get into. And then we got the fight with Hamsho, and like you said, I mean, I saw that fight about 20 years later. I watched it on video because I didn't have a copy of it, and then it came up on YouTube or something. And after the first five rounds, I thought, how the hell did I win this fight? And this guy won every minute of it so far, you know. But, yeah, then the last half of it, I guess, you know, it went my way. And I mean, I really, really, really loved that fight because he was such a dirty fighter. I'd been written off by everybody, even people around me. And I worked so hard to get ready for that fight, and I knew that by winning that fight, if Michael Spinks moved up to heavyweight, I was actually going to get a shot at a world title, which was my dream, which was really a fantasy. I mean, I had no logical reason in the physical condition I was in to contemplate being a world champion, but I did from the very beginning. So it was just such an awesome victory. I still consider it probably my favorite fight, you know, maybe of my career, because it was such a crossroads fight. I either was making it, or at least getting a shot truly to make it, or it was going to be all over. So that was one of my favorite fights in my whole career, the Hamsho fight. He was as dirty as he was reputed to be. Low blows, elbows, headbutts, everything he could do. And then the Davis fight, I mean, you can't, you know, dream of a better outcome. I mean, Eddie Davis had fought Michael Spinks, who I consider, and at the time considered, you know, maybe the greatest light heavyweight of all time. I mean, Bob Foster, Mike Spinks, who else? And Davis, you know, I mean, it was only, I think, 20 months earlier they had fought that 15-round war. And, you know, everybody in boxing, literally everybody in boxing said, I'm just going to get annihilated. The only reason I'm going to fight because I'm white, Dave Wolf put the fight together. If it wasn't for Dave's power with Mancini, I would never be there. I was uncoordinated. I mean, the things just went on and on about how inept I was and how, I mean, if you read the stories previous to that fight, it was the most vile, repulsive writing about anybody's chance of ever making it in the sport by any of these writers. It was unbelievable. And then to come out of it with just annihilating him in 3 minutes and 20 seconds or something like that. I think he was down at least three times, and I don't know if he ever recovered from that punch in the second round that ended it. So, of course, you can imagine how rewarding that whole situation was. It was literally, I mean, a fantasy come true.
What were your thoughts when you were when you first found out you were going to fight Sugar Ray Leonard, and what are your memories of that fight?
Well, when I first found out about it, Tommy Gallagher helped put that fight together, which is really how he ended up becoming my trainer. But anyway, he put that fight together, and they started that fight before he even fought Davis, like over a year before. And we were at the gym one day in Queens at his gym, and he says, hey, Donnie, come on downstairs. I want to talk to you about something. So I went private, and I went down. And he was like, I'm going to ask you a question. Don't you ever repeat it to anybody. and I'll tell you when you can talk about it again, but here it comes. She goes, would you fight Sugar Ray Leonard for $1 million? You gotta remember, at the time, nobody in the light heavyweight division made any money. And if it is, $300,000 maybe, you know? And I hadn't even beaten Davis yet. So, and I'm just coming off being a cripple. I mean, like, it was just such a surreal thing to hear, not to mention I had never, ever considered fighting Ray Leonard because he was a welterweight. So I just said, Tommy, I would fight Ray Leonard for nothing. And I laughed. I go, are you kidding me? And he goes, don't you ever say that again. And I said, well, I'm serious. I said, I would do it just for fun. I would love to fight Ray Leonard. I boxed Lennox Lewis for fun in 83 just because I needed some sparring and wanted some sparring. I mean, it wasn't so much fun, but I thought it would be. But anyway, so, my God, did he hit hard. But anyway, for me, anyway. So that's when I first found out about it, and that was my response to it. And so I said, yes, Tommy, I will fight Ray Leonard for any amount of money, and I would love the fight, yes. And I said, but he will never take this fight. I said, he might be crazy enough to sign it and announce it, but he will retire or find a way not to make the fight. Because I don't care how talented he is, I'm still a light heavyweight, and I still punch too hard for any welterweight, you know. So that was kind of how I took it. And then how I think and feel about the fight, I mean, the first four rounds, it went exactly how it should have gone. I completely outboxed him, knocked him down, had him cut. It was like completely one-sided. And I don't mean to say that because I'm a better fighter than Ray Leonard. I mean to say that because at that point in time, Ray Leonard had no business in the ring with a light heavyweight, and he had almost no chance to win that fight because I don't care what you say about my ability. I could punch, like, really well. Ask Eddie Davis. Ask many people I fought. I could punch very hard and very precise. And all I had to do was hit Ray once properly, and it was over. So after the fourth round, when he went down, as he went down, I'm walking to the neutral corner, the thought that went through my mind was, this fight's over next time I hit him. So, of course, I changed my fight style. Instead of doing what I did that led to that knockdown and the cut and the hurting him, I started waiting for him to leave an opening for me to land that one punch. And as everybody knows, when you watch the fight, from the fifth to eighth round, he wins most of it. Not all of it, but most of it. But I was just kind of completely out of my fight plan. And then in the ninth round, I kind of got it back together. In the first half a minute, he didn't touch me. I could barely get to him. He was being very careful because he couldn't get in. And then I caught him with a really nice uppercut. I threw punches for literally 2 minutes and hit him literally, as the saying goes, from pillar to post. And I'm looking around at the referee. Like, what do you want me to do, kill this old man? Back then, 32 was old. For a welterweight, it was ancient. So I literally thought he was a fat old welterweight that I was going to hurt. And Ray saw that sort of moment, jumped in, threw a million punches, and by the end of it, hit me in the larynx. My larynx was crushed in that punch, and that's why I went down. I was conscious. I was cognizant. If you look at the tape, I won. Richard Steele's down there. He's holding my shoulders, and I'm saying, let me out. Like, I was trying to say, let me out, but then I realized I couldn't speak because my larynx was crushed. So obviously they thought I was more hurt, and they didn't let me out. And so the fight was ended. I mean, rightfully, when you look at it, it should have been ended, but at the time, I still thought it should have kept. Because 20 seconds earlier, I thought it was over the other way. You know, so really, in my opinion, I mean, if people can say whatever they want. Ray, when he writes in his book, he downplays it very much. I beat him almost the whole fight. There's no reason why I shouldn't have knocked him out. The only reason I didn't knock him out was because of losing so much weight. I didn't have the power late in the fight. Not even late in the fight. The whole fight, I didn't have nearly the power I normally do. But that wasn't because of 168. It was because I way overtrained for the fight. I sparred way too many rounds, and I ran way too much. And I'm not blaming anybody, but I'm just saying that's what happened. I should never have gone in the ring that week. I was 163 pounds. I weighed 167 at the weigh-in, but if you notice, I had all my clothes on because that's how weak I was. I couldn't sweat for a week before the fight.
real quick, I want to get this in because about 5 minutes left in the show. Actually, I mean, we could probably do a three-parter about your boxing career because there's a ton of other things I know Joe and I both want to ask you. But I think it's very important that we get out the initiative you're doing with the TKOOO to Taking Care of Its Own. It's a mission to educate fighters and benefits of natural and preventative medicine. Do you want to explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thank you. This came about from, you know, I retired from boxing in 2003 from an eye injury a week before the Hill fight. And then I moved to Costa Rica because I really had to get away from boxing or I would have kept wanting to do it. So I did. And then, as you know, my kids got older and I started getting some more time freed up again, I decided to get back into boxing. I went to a couple boxing conventions to kind of get a feel for who's who and what's going on. And I recognized and realized how many people and how damaged a lot of the guys were. The guys that I knew, you know, guys that are from my era, guys from older, past eras also, of course, but it just kind of made me realize the best thing I could do is share my knowledge and my experience of natural medicine. And so I thought, take care of our own people. That's what I need to do. I need to, like, get across to these guys that there are natural ways. I know that there are no medical ways, for instance, to do specific things to help Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or dementia, but I know there are definitely natural ways that you can reduce, minimize the symptoms, and improve tremendously your quality of life. And so I just felt I needed to share this stuff, and I came up with the concept. Unfortunately, coincidentally, right at the same time, is right around when this financial crisis happened, the economic thing, and I was really hurt badly in Costa Rica in real estate by that. So I was really sort of like my hands were tied in regards to what I could put out into the initiative, as well as the freedom I had to go and put energy into it as well, as well as money. So it's been a slow start, but I'm now getting back on my feet. Everything's getting back together, and I'm able to spend more time, energy, and money on the initiative again. And I've come across, as it seems to happen in life, I've come across some brilliant people that are very willing to help and contribute, which is what I need. I thought I'd get more support from the sanctioning bodies, honestly, but I didn't get any from any of them. And, you know, they'll give $1 million to a pharmaceutical hospital or something to try and find a pill that's going to cure somebody, but that's not the answer. I mean, that might be an answer one day, and I hope that for everybody's sake that happens. But in the meantime, what about all these guys that are living in squalor and living in, you know, very, very sad physical states and financial states? How about helping these guys? So in the meantime, so that's what the initiative is all about. It's about getting to the guys, getting them some natural health products and treatments, helping them recover and then get sort of a life going again for themselves. So the first thing to do is get them healthy and then get them sort of steered in the right direction of utilizing the amazing name and career they had and what they can do with that. And so that's basically the broad strokes of what the initiative is about. And when we have a lot more time in the future, maybe we could take the time you mentioned, maybe we could do a whole show just on TK.
Yeah, I mean, right now we've got about a minute left. But sometime this week or weekend, we'll get together. We'll work out something to do a show on it. I know it's very near and dear to me and Joe's both. I mean, Joe's mom is suffering from Alzheimer's. My mom just passed away from dementia. And let's face it, there's no money for pharmaceutical companies to cure stuff. You know, so there has to be another way to go about combating this stuff. And I would love to have you back anytime to talk about that.
Well, I'd be very happy to do that, and the sooner the better. On the mother who's still around, I'm very, very sorry for the loss. But for people that are suffering right now, there are some tremendous options for them to certainly increase the quality of life they have right now. And a lot of people have come all the way back, so I wouldn't count that out either. It's really phenomenal, and I'm literally sitting here after meetings all day in business in Las Vegas of some phenomenal products. for this reason.
Hey, we got-